Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here and kick off this session. I wanted to acknowledge Atin for orchestrating this and keeping on nudging us to get our presentations in. I'm going to kick off this session, so I'm going to kind of give a big picture view of water issues. As Mark said, I'm the National Program Director for Drinking Water Research, so in looking forward at drinking water issues that confront the U.S., the sort of the tone of this this presentation is to kind of take a forward look at what are some of the issues that that confront the water industry. So basically, I'm going to talk a little bit about water resource management and some of the challenges, and then I'm going to kind of give a big picture view of a drinking water system. So looking at sources of drinking water, treatment practices, and water infrastructure, talk a little bit about the regulatory framework, and some of the challenges. And then the subsequent presentations will go into a lot more detail, primarily on pathogens and public health risks. So this is kind of a busy slide, but I just wanted to sort of start out by saying, from a water resource management point of view, water is a finite and non-renewable resource that can be recovered, reused, and repurposed. And so when we think about drinking water systems, you know, sort of the paradigm in the U.S. is that there's ample water, and we don't really need to worry about the overall quality of water. And so. So I think it's important to sort of start out by recognizing that there's only a finite amount of water that's available, and we need to be more strategic and more deliberate about the way we manage the water. Some of the water issues confronting the globally are the availability of water and its quality. And so how can we ensure that there's adequate water supply as well as an adequate quality of that water supply? I'm not going to go through all the details on here. So if we think about water availability, in different parts of the U.S., there are different stressors on water availability. So in some areas, there are competing demands for water use. In urban areas, there's sometimes conflicts between municipal, commercial, and domestic water needs. In agricultural areas, there's sometimes conflict, particularly out west, between the amount of water needed to irrigate as well as the amount of water needed to supply urban systems. And there's also a lot of water needed to produce energy, and also water consumes energy. So there's an energy-water nexus. In recent times, there's been concerns about climate change and the seasonal variability in water availability. And so in different parts of the country are confronted by those issues in different ways. And the other fact that's sort of on the front burner is water infrastructure. The infrastructure that supplies drinking water in the U.S. as well as this infrastructure that collects wastewater has been in place in some cases for well over 100 years. And so as the infrastructure ages, it becomes more vulnerable to failures and leaks that not only compromise its reliability but also affect the water quality. So I just wanted to sort of give a sort of overview of water, drinking water systems in the U.S. So if we look at the U.S., there are about 160,000 public water systems, and collectively, those systems serve 300 million people. So it's really important that we are able to ensure the quality and reliability of those water systems. If we sort of drill down a little bit, we can look at sort of the water that's supplied in the U.S., how much of it is coming from groundwater sources and how much is coming from surface water sources. And we can also look at the sizes of the systems. And so while this is a little bit of a busy slide, I guess the key points are that these dots refer to the population and the bars refer to the number of systems. And so basically what this upper graph shows is that there's a lot of systems that provide groundwater and fewer systems that provide surface water, but there's a larger population served by surface water than by groundwater. And these are only public systems, so private water systems don't really get documented in the same way. Within the public water systems, they range in size. So of the public water systems, there's about 54,000 community water systems, and then there are smaller systems that are that serve sort of smaller subpopulations in that are not serving the same population consistently. And I guess I also wanted to point out that when water systems are put into place, when water treatment plants are designed, they're usually designed for about a 20-year design life. And when water infrastructure is designed, it's usually designed for about a 50-year design life. And in reality, they all last a whole lot longer than that. So as they get towards the end of their design life, they obviously aren't going to, in most cases, deliver at the same quality as they were as when they're newer. Okay, so in terms of water quality, which from a public health point of view is front and center, so what are the concerns that affect public health? And basically, if we think about the way water is used and the way water is managed, then we can sort of quickly see that the way we manage water in the environment affects what's in water. So in a city, water we derive water from a source, we use it for drinking water, and then it becomes wastewater. So we put in different types of components into the water. We also have runoff from rainwater and other sources. So collectively, all of these different factors affect the quality of water. There are also climate-induced water quality stressors, and so as water temperatures change, as water availability changes, that affects the chemistry of water as well as its microbiology. And then I kind of already talked about infrastructure. The infrastructure affects the quality of water because as pipes age, they start to leak, and we have the opportunity for intrusion of different types of contaminants into water systems. So from the drinking water point of view, what we typically do is adopt what we call a multiple barrier approach to protecting public health. And so basically the multiple barriers is water, drinking water comes from, in most cases, a source water, so a fresh water supply, or it could also be a saline supply, or from wells, from groundwater. And we take that water and we treat it to varying degrees depending on where it's coming from. And the overall approach in the Safe Drinking Water Act is that all of the water leaving a water treatment plant should be of a similar quality, of a minimum quality. Then we put that water into distribution systems and send it through pipes and storage tanks to where it's used. And so the multiple barriers are, first we try to protect the sources of water, wellhead protection, or trying to protect water supply sources. Then we use different an array of treatment processes depending on this type of treatment plant. And then we have other barriers within the distribution system to protect public health. So if we look at what the water quality concerns are, is depending on where the water is from, there can be contaminants due to agriculture, industry, municipalities, or wet weather flows. So some of the contaminants that are of concern are pathogens, and we'll be hearing a lot more about that in the subsequent talks. Nutrients get into water systems, and nutrients, nitrogen can form nitrite and nitrate, which are regulated contaminants. But nutrients can also trigger algal blooms, and algal blooms can then produce cyanobacterial toxins and other toxins that can have health impacts. There are also organics in water that can serve as precursors for disinfection byproducts, and there are also inorganics, metals, arsenic, things like that. So from a drinking water point of view, our goal is to try to mitigate to the best extent that we can the potential health risks associated with this wide array of contaminants that differ in quality, concentration, and frequency in which they're in water. And some of the contaminants that are of concern are pesticides, herbicides, and insecticides, and many of these are regulated. Solvents, and some of these are regulated. Metals, many of these are regulated. Fuel drive components, some of these can get into water through leaking tanks. Currently, there's a lot of interest in biofuels, and biofuels, as they start to emerge into the marketplace, may introduce other water quality concerns that aren't quite in step with the current regulations. There's a lot of attention right now on and there's a variety of acronyms as well, on emerging pollutants of concern, or micropollutants, or PPCPs, but there's a lot of attention on pharmaceutically active compounds. There's a growing database that shows that there are very low levels of these compounds in water. There's a lot of uncertainty about what the true health risks are, but it's certainly an active area of research. Endocrine active compounds and byproducts of household products. There's also a lot of attention to injectates, so things that we inject into water from the point of view of either recharging groundwater or aquifer storage and recovery. And also there's currently a lot of interest in using the groundwater to sequester carbon dioxide. And so there's questions about what kinds of public health impacts might be associated with those activities. From a regulatory point of view, the drinking water in the U.S. is regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Other legislative authorities that relate to drinking water or water in general are the Clean Water Act. And then all of these other legislative authorities that are listed here affect what might impact the water system. I just wanted to, I think sometimes it's kind of interesting to sort of look at where we are today and how we got there. And so I wanted to just have a, just take a minute to talk about some of the assumptions that underlie the existing regulations. And so in the Clean Water Act, the Clean Water Act really regulates discharges into water bodies. And the underlying assumption is that there's adequate dilution and assimilative capacity in a receiving water to protect water quality. And so this sort of predates some of the concerns about trace contaminants. And the standards in the Clean Water Act are based on protection of aquatic species. Within the Clean Water Act, there's compliance monitoring, which is monitoring real general sort of parameters, things like biochemical oxygen demand, solids, and nutrients. And so we don't really collect on a regular basis lots of detailed data about what's in a discharge. And then we also assume that there's some mixing and some ability to assimilate discharges. From the Safe Drinking Water Act point of view, the Safe Drinking Water Act in its early days really was based on assuming that we have adequate and abundant clean sources of drinking water and that there's a finite number of contaminants that should be regulated. And in general, when you look at the Safe Drinking Water Act, the general premise is that groundwater is less vulnerable to contaminants than surface water. So generally, there's fewer contaminants or fewer regulations that relate to groundwater, although some of those types of things are changing. From a monitoring point of view, we monitor a few things daily, and periodically we monitor water for the primary drinking water standards. And so from the drinking water point of view, we sort of use the multiple barriers and the regulatory framework to provide baseline data on water quality, but we do not routinely provide data on some of these emerging contaminants that I mentioned before. So the questions are, you know, is this regulatory framework meeting today's needs? It doesn't really speak to water availability. It doesn't really speak to what are the climate-induced impacts and how might we adapt or mitigate those. And it doesn't really get into energy-water linkages or some of the economic realities. So as we become more concerned about water quality and we impose more regulations, there's an additional cost to deliver that water. But within the regulatory framework, we do have some mechanisms in place that can accommodate emerging contaminants. Within the Safe Drinking Water Act, there's a 6-year review of existing regulations. And so that gives the EPA an opportunity to look at our current practices and ask if there's new science and new developments that make us reconsider the current regulations. We also have the contaminant candidate list, which is a 5-year cycle in which the agency comes up with a list of what are the highest priority contaminants that might pose health risks and should they be regulated. And then there's also the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, which gives the EPA a way to look at what's really in drinking water supplies. So the questions are, you know, are there enough safeguards in our current regulatory frameworks? What about the co-occurrence of contaminants? Most of the contaminants, or all of the contaminants in the Safe Drinking Water Act, are regulated on a one-by-one basis, but we are exposed to them in combinations of various sorts. What about the water infrastructure? What types of health and ecological data are needed to provide adequate protection? In the past several years, there's been more and more developments on toxicity testing. We now have tools to look at reproductive effects and endocrine effects and a wider array of health effects than the original set of drinking water regulations. So when is enough enough, and how much data do we need to be able to really ensure that the water is safe? And so those are just some of the background about emerging contaminants. I just want to take a minute to just talk about the, so that's sort of just a general discussion on water quality. I want to take a little bit, a minute or two to just talk about treatment practices. So water comes from different sources in general, either groundwater or surface water. Surface water treatment systems, for the most part, if you looked at the inventory of surface water treatment systems out there, the majority of them are what would be considered conventional treatment. So conventional treatment means you're getting water from an open water source, you add some chemicals to promote removal of particles, aggregation of particles, you use some physical processes to either settle the particles or filter the particles, add a disinfectant to inactivate the pathogens, and then you put the water into a distribution system. The majority of monitoring that occurs is right after the water leaves the treatment plant and before it goes into the distribution system. So we have a lot less data on what occurs in distribution systems with the exception of a few parameters. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the water distribution system or the water infrastructure. And I think it's kind of interesting to look back and sort of say, how did we get the infrastructure that we currently have? And if you look at water supply systems, the oldest ones in the U.S. started around 1700, and they were initially put in for putting out fires, so provide a pressurized source of water to put out fires in urban areas. And then that sort of evolved into delivering an uninterrupted source of pressurized water. And the first systems were actually here in Philadelphia. And then in 1908, that was really when the first water system was chlorinated. So that was really when the first connection between adding chlorine as a disinfectant chemical and drinking water sort of came into place. So currently we really have a variety of infrastructure in the U.S. that varies in age, but it's sort of all predicated from these early days. So we design water systems today to fight fires. We size a water system to provide enough water to put in to put out a fire, as opposed to ensuring as opposed to just the potable part of it. From the wastewater point of view, since wastewater affects drinking water, it's kind of important to look at those in parallel. And much of the infrastructure is in parallel. So in a right-of-way under a road, you'll have a water supply line somewhere in the proximity of a wastewater collection line. Early wastewater systems were put in to flush sewage away from where people were, and early wastewater systems were also put in to use rainwater to do that. Now we know that there's a lot of energy costs associated with those types of practices, and also it's better to keep the water where we need it. And then I wanted to just talk a little bit about sort of health risks related to infrastructure. Basically, so in a water infrastructure, in a drinking water system, we put water into a pipeline under pressure. We store some of the water in the system, and we keep that under pressure, and we deliver it to water systems. So some of the things that we're concerned about and we're looking at within the EPA are what happens to when you have cracks or pressure transients in a system. What happens to do contaminants enter the system, and can they pose health risks? What kinds of reactions occur in storage tanks? Do we get microbial growth? Do we get sedimentation or particulate formation? And what about the biofilms that form in distribution systems, as well as in some cases where we use chloramines for disinfectant, what about the formation of nitrite and nitrate in the system? So one of the things that we're focused on in EPA is how can we better ensure that the infrastructure protects public health, and we're kind of focusing on some of these issues: cross connections, backflow, intrusion, breaches, main breaks and repairs, and some of the internal reactions. And the other topic that's relevant to distribution systems is disinfection byproducts. And this can be sort of thought of as a risk trade-off. We add disinfectant chemicals. I mentioned before about chlorine. These disinfectant chemicals are important because they control pathogens, but they also react to form disinfection byproducts. And these are an array of products that form in chemicals that form in water that are perceived to pose health risks. And so there's a little bit of a balancing act between making sure that we can disinfect water appropriately, but preventing the formation of these byproducts. And some of the other reactions that occur in distribution systems are corrosion reactions. So when water goes through a pipeline, this is a copper pipe, you can get sediments accumulating on the surface, and you can also get leaching occurring that will distribute those constituents into water. And the other evolving issue, or that issue that's getting a lot of concern, is water and energy. Water is 8.34 pounds per gallon, and we spend a lot of money moving it from place to place. I think the state of California, the statistics are about 20% of their energy is just to move water from one place to another. So as we move forward, we need to protect public health, but we also need to do it in an energy efficient way. So to sort of summarize, I know I've kind of given a broad brush here, there's increasing pressures on the availability of water, energy use, and the carbon footprint of water systems, as well as water quality pressures. There's been advances in treatment technologies. We have better analytical methods, modeling, monitoring, and mapping, so we can better understand the types of contaminants that are in water and where they're coming from. There's been movements towards better integration of water resource management, which I didn't really get into in this presentation, but in many parts of the country, water reuse is becoming part of the overall water management structure. As we move forward, we need to ensure that there are adequate safeguards in place to continue to protect public health. And the big challenges are waterborne contaminants, water availability, and infrastructure. Within EPA, we have the Office of Research and Development, and we have a website where you can learn a little bit about some of the work that we're doing, and my contact information is there. And I think I'll stop there. Take questions, or should we?
We have time for a few questions.